It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. A most recent column for the Westchester Guardian on It's Not All Bad, Is It? No, But... is or soon will be available at the website www.westchesterguardian.com. It is the 131st column in the Creative Disruption series. In relation to this show, I've set up the GoFundMe site to try to ensure its ongoing sustainability. But as yes, the response has been underwhelming. But you can change that. I do need to publicize it more. The actual URL is available at my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com. Also, at the same website, are links to my occasional 15-minute radio show, John Mack Rants. Callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756, and I certainly hope you will call in tonight. I do hold the on-air participation to when I'm not speaking with my guest. My guest next week on this show is Gene Schneider, a technologist and manager in both the private and public sector. He's with IBM for years, entrepreneur, political activist, and my second oldest friend. The reason he's my second oldest friend is he was born approximately 3 months after my oldest friend, Kevin Buckley. Tune in and listen. My guest tonight, for the second time, was supposed to be writer, editor, educator, and technologist Stephen Cherry. He has not yet arrived in the studio. It's possible that he got hung up or that he missed the show because of the holiday. So we'll go on without him. I've been going to monthly meetings of the group called the Narrowbacks. The Narrowbacks is an interesting connection of people from various walks of life in the New York area, mainly people beyond the age of 50. Many of them are police officers, direct police officers, or attorneys, or writers. And it meets on McLean Avenue in Yonkers, which is really there's a whole section of Irish-type pubs there. The most well-known is Rory Dolan's, but there's a whole bunch there. And the word Narrowbacks comes from second generation, generally Irish American. The first generation was the Broadbacks, the people that had to labor, to work hard, to establish themselves and their family in the United States. It was only the second and third generation that had the opportunity to become educated and to not to labor as hard. About 6 months ago, the group changed the name of the Narrowback to the Narrowbacks private first class Thomas Minogue chapter, and that was to honor the younger brother of some friends of mine, Kevin and Jack Minogue, who and the younger brother was killed in Vietnam. Won honors for his valor. He covered the body of the wounded a platoon leader, and he was killed in the process. But the platoon leader recovered and was able to call in artillery and Air Force cover to drive the enemy away from his unprotected outfit. So in his action, Tom Minogue really saved the whole unit. He has, I believe, the distinct service cross, and there is some congressional support for him to receive the Medal of Honor. The Narrowbacks meet in the Heritage on McLean Avenue at 12 noon every third Thursday of the month. And at the next meeting, I'm going to read, as I did at the last, some of my early poetry. And the first poem that I ever wrote, it was brought out by two things. I was an English major at Iona College, and I hadn't read the poem from the day I graduated for about 45 years. And now I happened to be passing through the Barnes & Noble, where I tend to hang out, and I passed this shelf that had some poetry books, and a title by Charles Bukowski just caught my attention. So I picked up the book. I started to browse through it, and I said, you know, this fellow's crazy, and he writes crazy stuff. Then I could do that. So I forgot about it for a while, and until I was going through the motorcycle magazine, I ride the motor scooter, at that time probably the motorcycle, and there was the great line in it that caused me to write my first poem, which was Cashing a Check, and it goes like this. I saw this wonderful line in a column in the motorcycle magazine. The mind writes checks that the body can't cash. The vision from the old neighborhood have of me is short and thin, with a Pepsi in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Others will remember me as tall and thin, hitting a jumper from the corner or throwing a no-look pass to a cutter. Others will picture me at the end of the Broadstone with an open pack of Pall Mells and a half-finished beer in a bar, Don Gibson's I Can't Stop Loving You on the jukebox. Oh, Pat, one more and you have a chance. Age has taken the jumper. Diabetes has taken the Pepsi. Common sense has taken the cigarette and booze. I am older and wiser and hopefully more tolerant. I'm satisfied with my life, but to be able once more, just once more, to fake the man guarding me and go up with a jump and get nothing but net. To be able once more to cash that check. Another poem that has the basketball background is 1958. I drive deep into the right corner and go up in the air, hang tank for an instant and get nothing but net. Afterwards, one of the players in our younger team, Vinny Bernadetto, asked me how I stay up in the air so long. Vinny died last week. So I cleared the rebound, turned, and hit Buddy Kelly streaking down court for a layup. Buddy died over 10 years ago. Bob Cummings takes a rebound, gives it to me, and then I find John Murray with the bounce basket as he cuts to the basket. Two more points. Both Bob and John have been dead for over 10 years. After the game, Coach Jim McArdle pats me in the ass and says, nice game. Jim has been dead for over 20 years. Bob Gorman and Jerry Moran walk up the stairs with me to the locker room. They're both gone too. Sometimes I remember too much. I'll read two more poems while we wait for Steve. Ted Williams was the best hitter that I ever saw. John Glynn said Williams was the best pilot he ever knew. Williams was the real John Wayne, serving in two wars and always his own man, fighting with sports writers, but always helping young players. Williams' flair for the dramatic was legendary. Home runs in the All-Star games, the homer in his last game before leaving to Korea. His homer in his last at-bat in his last game at Fenway Park was so dramatic that the call by the late Kurt Gowdy is legendary. And the piece describing it by the great John Updike is in many anthologies. He was the last player to hit 406 in 1941. When he died, his son had him frozen. Why? So that he may return. As what? Teddy Ballgame, the kid, the splendid splinter, Theodore Samuel Williams, R.I.P. But is he? And then we were talking at the last the Narrowback lunch about the old neighborhood that I grew up in, Dinwood, which many of you have heard me speak of, and there's been a number of guests on the show from Dinwood. And the guest next week, Gene Schneider, as I mentioned, is one of my oldest friends from the neighborhood. Well, when we were in our high school years, and even into our college years, we used to go to Friday night dance in Good Shepherd Parish. And this is called, surprisingly, the Friday night dance. On Friday night, we'd get suited up and head down to the local Catholic grammar school for teenage dance. When we got a bit older, we'd kill a half pint of old Mr. Boston Blumen flavored vodka first. I'd be wrapped around a girl in slow dance, my hand caressing her hair as my torso tried to join hers, and Father Divine would wander over and say, "Leave room for the Holy Ghost." That statement might have opened up space between some other bodies, but I would make the point that the Holy Ghost is spiritual father. He can fit anywhere he wants. 50 years later, after winning a Silver Star as the Vietnam chaplain, he still remembers those remarks. If a young lady returns at such a dance to dance again, she had to really like me, for I would have been singing in her ear with the worst singing voice in the world. Oh, well, it was prior to the pill, and his girls didn't put out anyhow, so we drank. As I mentioned earlier, I ride the motor school now, and I wrote a poem of the faith. It's easier to believe in a concerned God when motor scooting down to Taconic over to Croton Reservoir on a spring day. At 60, with the wind in your face under the blue sky, I'm sure that God is in his heaven, and I whisper, "Thank you." It's not as easy on a rainy, cold day. The poem with a bit of a theological bent is called The Christian Corporation. The startup was founded by a young Galilean with the idea of saving men's souls. Every startup needs a goal. He recruited the best freelancers around, a dedicated bunch, much like the ones that Apple, Microsoft, and Google. The venture stumbled a bit when one of the key players, Judas, went over to the other side. But the resurrection became the iPod of the day, and the venture was back on track. As the enterprise grew, there was resentment, envy, and even hate from the existing establishment, much as was felt by those at Apple, Microsoft, and Google. As the enterprise grew further, though, it was necessary to first bring in venture capital and then to go public. Eventually, new management arrived. The stocks split, and the mystics, itinerant preachers, hermits, and martyrs became minority stockholders. Very minority. Does anyone notice that Apple only got back on track when the founder was brought back? Does anybody know where that Galilean can be found? We'll take a short music break, and I mentioned the people from Inwood to have been on this show, and the ones who will be coming back, and for me, that's pretty close to this.
Gonna take a mental journey. Gonna set my heart at ease.
On my way.
Gonna make a sentimental journey.
Hey, hey.
To renew old memories.
Memories.
Got my bag. I've got my reservation. Any time I could afford. Like a child in wild anticipation.
Before I get back to the poetry, and this doesn't have to do with particularly either party, although Elizabeth Warren has been the one that's been speaking of it the much. I am extremely upset that no one who has perpetrated any of these banking crimes has gone to prison. My ex-bank, HSBC, the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, that I had because my employer used the bank and directly deposited for us, admitted to money laundering for criminals, for drug dealers, for the mob, and paid a $6 billion fine. But no one went to prison. No one was indicted. No one was even named in the press. Someone within that bank had to make the decision that we will take the money from these drug dealers and we will launder it. And they should have gone to prison. The whole term, too big to fail, is really also too big to jail. There were other crimes or criminal acts to which many of the banks paid for during a concern with the mortgage problems and with lending money to people that should not have received it, and they paid money to, once again, these are criminal acts, and someone should have gone to jail. Okay, back to the literature, and this is my doctor, my druggist. My doctor, the literate fellow, he was a former journalist, wrote on the prescription pad, one pills, thrice a day. I wondered if any of his patients mistook this for twice a day. But my druggist, having no confidence in Devox Populi, typed in a battle, one pill, three times a day. I went through a period that I was, that my brother, who a number of people who have appeared on this show, or know me personally, or listen to the show, know that my brother died of a terrible, depressing death of Alzheimer's. But the period was that my brother was in a hospital with this, and my mother-in-law, who had first broken a hip and then had a stroke, was in a nursing home. And I wrote something about nursing homes. I've been in maximum security prisons as a consultant. The prison, people with dead eyes and intimidating looks, doors that won't open until the one behind it closes. But I've always thought it was the most depressing place in the world. Wrong. My mother-in-law is in a nursing home, a very good one. At age 91, she has an artificial knee, an artificial hip, the broken hip, fixed with screws. Then is the stroke victim. And she is one of the best of the lot. People staring off into space, or babbling, or looking as thin as Holocaust survivors. God, get me the fuck out of here. It's more depressing than a prison, because I know I'll never go to prison. And maybe we'll do one or two more, and then we'll go on. I mentioned my brother. The rape of the mind. If you're ever sitting at a bar and you get your back to the wall on sports trivia, quietly ask, okay, who signed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's high school diploma? The answer is Robert McMullen, my brother, the best person that I ever knew. He was the principal at Palm Memorial High School at the time. Unfortunately, in the last years of my brother's life, he wouldn't remember Lou Alcindor, Kareem's original name, at all. In fact, he didn't know who I was. He had Alzheimer's, dirty, rotten fucking Alzheimer's. All his life, he read. He read books on theology, on sports, particularly baseball, on sociology, on anthropology. Whenever he was outside of his house, he carried a book, always with a book, all sucking in knowledge, facts, and understanding. And before he died, it was all gone. What's in a name? I was baptized John Francis. John after my father, the tough New York City cop. Francis after my uncle, the Washington lawyer, bred as a Boston Puritan. For confirmation, I took Robert Joseph. Robert after my brother, 16 years older than me and a member of a religious order, the best person I've ever known. Joseph, because I damn well felt like it. Even at 10, I was a pain in the ass. Both my father and uncle drank scotch. My uncle for a few, my father until it was gone. My father was one of the most generous men I've ever known. My brother inherited his generosity. Both my father and uncle bullied my mother, as did I. No one outside the family could ever bully her. My mother, the quiet, but tough Boston babe, a Charleston townie. When my father died, an untimely death. Hell, all deaths are untimely. And my uncle jumped in and helped support us. That's what families do. They all had charity, generosity, and love, hardwired into their Irish American genes. My father died still loved by my mother. My uncle died unloved by his wife, from whom he'd been estranged for over 50 years, but still lived with. That's what Boston Irish Catholic families do. my mother died in the nursing home, dazed and confused. She thought that the Hudson River outside her window was the child of her youth. And we usually did little to dissuade her of that belief. My brother died in the hospital, robbed of his brilliance by Alzheimer's and mourned by all who ever knew him. That leaves me with some tough acts to follow. And about my writing. As I mentioned earlier, I write a weekly column in the Westchester Guardian, and it's on the theme of creative disruption, how that the technology changes everything around us so often under our radar that we don't realize what's going on until years ago. Perhaps we might be walking through the local mall and say, didn't there used to be some film processing stores here, or didn't there used to be some music stores? And obviously they've been eaten up by digital cameras and by iTunes and the iPods and the iPhones. And digital cameras have been rather eaten up by the smartphones that have cameras in them. And people working for those organizations don't work there anymore. Then what happens to them? Do they get retrained? Do they have the education or the intelligence to be retrained? All of the online banking that we do, all the online paying bills, means that the people at the utility companies that used to be there to open envelopes don't do that anymore. And the people that used to validate that the checks had the account number on them or they were for the correct amount don't do that anymore. And the people that used to tabulate the checks for deposit and the banks don't do that anymore. The people who were making $250,000 at Eastman Kodak as vice presidents of chemical engineering don't have those jobs anymore. And there aren't jobs in that are looking for people with their skills because the whole film processing is gone. So what do these people do? Well, if they're young and dynamic, they possibly have other positions, or they may be defaulting on their mortgages or on car loans, or they may be sending children who would have gone to Ivy League schools to state universities. So there's a whole lot happening under the radar that we don't often see. And I've been writing about this, and I've been speaking about it at conferences, and I've taught volunteer courses to seniors at Marist College about it. And I think it's extremely important. But the only people that I have seen interested in it are two academics from MIT, and Robert Reich, and a handful of other people. Now, to be fair, some people are starting to be interested. I have had some communication with someone at the NF Science Foundation who has been charged with looking into what the possible impact is of technology innovation on the workforce. He's probably 5 years too late, but if we think of that our government can't deal with to whether to increase the debt maximum in 2 weeks, I worry about how they will do anything over the next 10 years. There are all sorts of different suggestions that at some point that the whole tax structure has to be revamped, and that there'll be less people supporting more as we know, corporate profits are up, the stock market's up, the 1% is getting wealthier, whereas the middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed. But obviously, this would take some real difficult political work because people that have don't want to give it up, and there are people who are just as happy to be bringing in profits from overseas sales in other places. In the papers last week, they mentioned that Hewlett-Packard will be separating into two companies, and they expect anywhere from 50 to 55,000 to be laid off. Google has employees in the in the 49,000 range. That means Hewlett-Packard will be laying off something the size larger than Google. It will come from all over the country and all over the world, though, so it won't be felt by any particular area. There will be a heavy hit in Silicon Valley. But we don't seem to have the focus on the changes that we do if a General Motors is going to go belly up and there's all those employees in the one place. So that's one of the things I've been writing about. The other thing is, I mentioned the poetry, and I'm also in the middle of my second novel. Both my anthology of poetry and poems, new and collected poems by John Macklin, the Bard. There's 110 of them in the book. That's up on Amazon, as is my The Inwood book. The Inwood book, it contains some poems about the old neighborhood, some short stories, and a novel and called Offering It Up. Well, the point of where I was going with this was that I've been writing for a long time, and I also have written for a number of publications. So I do have a poem, Me, then Me and Bobby McGee. I've been writing for over 25 years, news stories, articles, opinion columns, academic papers, encyclopedia entries, anthology pieces, a book, over 1,500 news stories, articles, and columns, and all in addition to the book. My writing has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, Computer Shop, National Review, PC Magazine, News Bites, Westchester Business Journal, Popular Electronics, and numerous publications no longer with us. I've written about important things: computer crime, government surveillance, outsourcing, education, technology innovation, cyberspace competition. More people have heard me and Bobby McGee than have read all of my work in total. Well, it's a very good song. I read a lot of books. I have to be able to write. And I teach. I teach two courses at Marist College. I teach a volunteer. I'm sorry. I teach two courses at the State University at Purchase, New York. I teach the volunteer course at Marist every semester to seniors, and I've taught I mentioned the Creative Disruption course. I've also taught on the history of computing, the history of Apple Computer, the history of Google. And to do this, I read a lot of books. Then I have a poem, I Buy Books. I buy books. I buy books on technology because I teach about technology. I buy books on poetry because I'm a poet. I buy books on politics because I vote. I buy mysteries because I've been writing one for 10 years. I buy books on religion because I'm searching. I buy books on economics because everything's about economics. I buy books on history because I want to know how we got here. I buy science fiction because I want to know where we are going. I buy books on science because I need to understand the science fiction. I buy novels because life is a story. I buy other books because I buy books. I buy books that I read. I buy books that I want to read. I buy books I never read because I've bought other books. I have books in bookcases. I have books in stacks. I have books in piles. I have books in the attic. I have books in the basement. I even have books in cars. I buy books when I get interested in subject. Three weeks ago, I had never heard of Charles Bukowski. Now I have 27 poems by him, a book about him, a DVD and audio tape by him, and I've read eight of them, listened to the audio tape, then watched half of the DVD. There was a place in the train station in Garrison, New York, called Guinan's. And it was owned by Jim Guinan, who came from Ireland on the Queen Mary with four children to find a better life in New York. He moved into temporarily into a cousin's apartment on Webster Avenue in the Bronx, on the fifth floor with the window guards so the children didn't fall out the window. And he looked out the window and he said, no, I don't want to live like this. That's not why I came here. So he went up to visit another cousin up in Garrison. And it turned out that there was a store in the train station that sold newspapers and things in the morning for people getting on the train. That also had the room in the back. And it had been selling beer out of coolers, the bar. There was a bar there. So Jim took it over. And it grew in popularity. He also had every Thursday after the full moon, people came from all over the Hudson, musicians, to play songs. And they would be in the bar. A nice weather, they'd be outside, right across the Hudson River from West Point. It was a beautiful place. And all sorts of people came from artisans, from people who to work down in the boats, to the governor of the state of New York who lived up the hill. And one of the poems that I read about that was I wrote about that was The Communion of Saints. It's Irish night at Guinan's, the first Thursday after the full moon, and the place is packed. And there is a harp, then a bod drum, and a few accordions, then a whistle, and a few guitars, and a few fiddles, and some singers, then a lot of beer. There are some writers, and then plumbers, then a governor with the state police card, and then restaurateurs, then real estate agents, and professors, and whoever else walks in. And there is much talk and gaiety until there is a hush when Jim is ready to sing, I'll take you home again, Kathleen. And we all listen. Kelly's behind the bar. Jim's in the kitchen. And we all take turns putting the money on the deli register. Trust abounds. Laughter is king. Joy reigns. Then we have friends, but people we don't even know. Then it ends, and we all go home. We are the funny people. Jim slowly gave up the bar to his son John. Jim had a diabetes and was difficult to work behind the bar, and John took over the management. And John was one of the strongest people that I've ever known, a very nice person. And then John got hit with seizures, and he had brain tumors, and he had four operations, perhaps five. And I used to ask him, I used to say, how are you feeling, John? And he would tell me, it wasn't looking for sympathy, that he would just tell me what was going on. And then he'd say, and I do what they tell me, and that's all I can do, John. Which he did. And then he died. And then Jimmy moved to Florida, and the bar was closed. And then Jim died, and I went to both their funerals. And it was very sad, and the place is not there anymore. And this is a place we all used to rush to get to. And we got to know people. And it was just a very nice 5 years of my life. There's a terrific book about it by a reporter to the Wall Street Journal, the Wendy Bounds. And it's called The Little Chapel by the River. And it was written before John got sick and passed away, and before Jimmy passed away. But it's a terrific read, and I would recommend it to anyone that might be interested in this story of a good old-fashioned pub and some good nights and some friends. Someday I will finish my novel. Someday I will write the great poem. Someday I will die. I wonder which will come first. And I was talking about my writing, and another poem, Why Do I Write? And this is at the time that I had taken a moratorium from my columns and my magazine writing, and I was working on the book. And why do I write? The answer was easier when I was paid for. But it's too much trouble now to never pay the rent anyhow. So why then? I know that others have written and everything I've thought, and some have undoubtedly done it better than I might. So why then? Writing prose helps me understand what I already know. Writing poetry helps me understand what I feel and remember. Or more simply said, I write because I must. I'm just browsing through to see if there's anything else that I might read. I know what I'll do. I will bring us a little more music while I go through this.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody. And I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration.
Particularly like that song by Billy Ward and the Dominoes, and also by Willie Nelson. As we reach a certain age, we realize that we're wiser than we ever were, and we're happy, at least I'm happy in my skin, but there are some things that hit you. This is senior benefits. When I was young and foolish, and the New York drinking age was 18, I'd often drink in bars at 16 and 17. It was never that I looked older. I certainly didn't. The bartenders just looked the other way. In fact, I was caught in New Jersey when the age was 21, when I was 26. This morning, I drove through a Dunkin' Donuts line and ordered the largest coffee they sell. The very polite young voice said, "That'll be $2.03. I drove to the window and taking a coffee, said two or three, right? I can speak in numbers. She said, "No, there's a special discount for you. I immediately thought that it must have been the millionth customer through, or was deemed the handsomest man of the day. Instead, she said, "It'll be $1.94. This is a senior citizen discount. You are a senior, aren't you?" If she hadn't been so nice, I would have said, "Keep your fucking 9 cents. Just give me the coffee." Instead, I nodded and gave the $2, then waited for change. Could also have some negatives. This is payback. When I was in my late teens and walking down Seaman Avenue with my mother on a cold and windy day, she would stop on the street and put her hand over her mouth. I would say, "What's wrong?" And when she replied, "Doesn't the wind just take your breath away?" I'd bark, "What? Come on, will you? Let's go." Now, after 40 years with asthma, the winter makes me pause to catch my breath and at times use an inhaler. My mother has been going for over 40 years, but when I stop, I can hear her say, "Doesn't the wind just take your breath away?" Payback. And the other thing is you remember things that are a little different from the people you might be speaking to. I mean, I've never heard of these things. Just sports memories. In 47, I heard Jackie Robinson break in. I saw Swiacki defeat the Army the same year. I saw the New York baseball Giants last game at the Polo Grounds in 1957. I took the goalpost home when United beat the Giants in overtime in 58. I saw Oscar get 56 to get Seton Hall later that year. I wound up in Joan Payson's private club when the Miracle Mets did it all in 1969. I saw Julius and the Nets win the ABA championship in 76. I was glued to the screen in 1980 when Bobby Nystrom beat Pete Peters in overtime to bring the Stanley Cup to Long Island. All great moments. But when I mention these things to my students, they don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But I'm also very tuned into language, being a writer, and I really look at language literally. I don't like people misusing terms. And I've the poem language, no matter how it seems from my writing, I don't use profanity often, at least verbally. I should hear my mind. I particularly don't use the magic word fuck as a noun, adjective, or exclamation. I use it as the great word for power for lovemaking and try to keep it at that. In fact, it bothers me inordinately when I hear others talking about the fucking rain, the fuck next door, or really got fuck when the horse fell. So when I stopped for a phone call at an outdoor phone and snow began to fall, that annoyed me when the fellow on the next phone in a voice said, "Hey, it's snowing like a motherfucker." I immediately grimaced and turned away, saying into my phone, "I hope he's not talking to his grandmother." But I became hysterical, the laughing, when it began to snow harder. And he said loudly, "Hey, now it's snowing like 10 motherfuckers." It wasn't a curse. It was a unit of measure. She looks at me quizzically, probably wondering, "What the fuck is this guy laughing at?" So that's my. I'll do another one that deals with also getting older and having things called hot cross buns. The hot cross buns are in the stores. They must be Lent. Every year for 60 years, I've had hot cross buns during Lent, but not this year. I have diabetes. So I made it through Advent without eggnog, but eggnog had only been for 50 years. But I know that there could be worse. I've had friends who have gone on to wherever. I wonder if wherever has hot cross buns. Do you feel sorry for yourself? Are you but your ass, or at least your hot cross buns? And I think that's all that we will do from my... This was from my first book of poetry called Cashing a Check. And it was the subtitle is Reflections by John F. McMullen as he enters his 70th year. And that was written in, that was copyrighted in 2008, 2009, and it has my pet hawk, who is no longer with us, on the cover. It's available from Amazon. But all of the poems that I like the best, they are all contained in the new and collected poems from John McDebard. As I mentioned, next week I'll be having Gene Schneider on the show. Now, I have had other people that I grew up with, Todd Roach and Dan Sheehan and Jim Casey on, as well as some other folks from Inwood, radio and television personalities, Steve McPartland, Thomas Kelly, who wrote a wonderful book called Rackets, about Inwood. And he also wrote another terrific book, Empire Rising, that's about the building of the Empire State Building. And Jim Taylor, who's a close friend, but I didn't know growing up in Inwood. He was just a little older than I was. So that was a whole different lifetime. And I'll play one more song that so reminds me of those years. Fantastic on the side of New York.
Down in front of cases, old brown wooden stoop. On a summer's evening, we formed a merry group. Boys and girls
together.
We were singing.
Sidewalks of New York. Now, tonight is the 57th show in the series. This is the second time that the guest has not appeared, and the first guest to do it, who totally made a mistake, was FBI, ex-FBI agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley, and she was extremely apologetic, and she came on 2 weeks later. And we had a wonderful show. All of the guests have not been from my old neighborhood. They were the minority. There's been writers like Steve Levy, who's currently with Medium, who was a columnist for both Newsweek and for Wired magazine, and also has written many books on technology. Has been the president of Marist College, Dennis Murray, the president of the West Community College, Joseph Hankin, who's just retired after 49 years, the longest reign of any community college president in the country. There's been the ex-lieutenant governor of New York State, Al Del Bello. There's been the ex-town supervisor of a neighboring town, Putnam Valley, a Democrat, and the present town supervisor, a Republican. There's been three religious leaders. One, the ex-Catholic pastor of the neighboring parish here, who was the chaplain for 25 years in the Air Force, and the pastor of the local Episcopalian church here, Mother Claire Woodley, as well as a retired pastor who was very active in the civil rights movement and other things, who was retired to Maine as a personal friend, Reverend Al Neese. Speaking of people who were active in the civil rights movement, Susan Brown Miller has been on the show. She was in Mississippi when the three New Yorkers had been murdered. And she later was well known as a writer of the feminist movement, as well as a writer for the Village Voice. Sally Winograto, who's known as both a writer and a photographer, and her second novel out was the recent guest, as is Kate Kelly, who had worked for CBS for a number of years and has the project going on of American Stories, and she's a website. If you do a site search on Kate Kelly. Upcoming guests are science fiction writer Walter John Williams, columnist for the New York Times magazine section, and the writer of a terrific article on Jeff Atichat. And let's Virginia Heffernan and other people planned throughout the end of the year. So as I said, this is the 57th show. It's the second show where we haven't had an expected guest. It's the first show that I've played music throughout, as well as telling my as reading poetry. And I'd welcome any callers. And if no callers are coming, we'll just call for the great Horst Silva, and we'll say thank you for listening. And this will be, the URL will be up on Facebook and other places. Steady Silva, steady. Okay. Keep moving, Tonto. Keep moving. Okay.